Poetry Parnassus, the largest poetry festival ever held in the UK, and Joe Shapcott is Britain's representative. Sarah also features as her essential CD of the week a recording of overtures by Thomas Arne in a performance by Collegium Musicum 90 under Simon Standage, and the Kuyken brothers are her artists of the week. Essential Classics starts at 9 and it's followed at midday by Mozart as composer of the week. And Mozart also features tomorrow evening along with Schumann and Beethoven when Radio 3 Live in Concert travels to Switzerland. For each of the past 11 years, the pianist Marta Argerich has assembled a group of friends, young and old, to perform music at her own festival on the banks of Lake Lugano. She's joined in this concert by two cellists, five pianists and a violinist, who all pair off to perform a series of chamber music duets. Radio 3 Live in Concert, tomorrow night, 7:30. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 11 o'clock. Time now for Jazz Lineup with Claire Martin.
Hello. The piano of Lynn Arial, and she talks to me after her recent sets at Ronnie Scott's Club. And later, an exclusive session from Shabaka Hutchins, and he talks to me about his current work. But first, this year's winner of Jazz Musician of the Year at the Parliamentary Jazz Awards, Scottish saxophonist and national treasure Bobby Wellens at his up-tempo best, from a re-release of a long unavailable recording, Birds of Brazil. Joined by a reflective Kenny Wheeler and the Delm String Quartet, with music composed and arranged by Bobby with orchestrations by Tony Coe, let's go back to 1982 and hear the second movement, which Wellens wrote to draw attention to the endangered species of a particular bird of Brazil. Pete Jacobson is on piano, Kenny Baldock on bass, Spike Wells on drums, and Chris Caron on percussion. This is Birds of Brazil.
Thank you.
from the re-release on the Hep Jazz record label. That was Bobby Wellens from the lost classic Birds of Brazil, which is now available again. This time there's a previously unreleased solo piano track featuring the late pianist Pete Jacobson as a tribute to him. We just heard the second movement from that CD, and both Bobby Wellens and Kenny Wheeler in fine form, and that re-release is out now. We're continuing to look back to the 80s, this time to 1986, the year that the 21-strong group of young musicians that made up Loose Tubes recorded their second of the three albums that they made between 1985 and 1989. Their witty attitude and desire to progress the music gained them critical acclaim, and they were considered to be the focal point, alongside the Jazz Warriors, of a 1980s renaissance. Here, from the said Africa recording, is a Django Bates composition with solos from Julian Arguelles, Richard Pywell and Steve Buckley, and this is Delightful Precipice.
Thank you.
Loose Tubes with Delightful Precipice. And Loose Tubes really became an amazing launchpad for the careers of many future leading jazz players, including the composer of that piece, Django Bates, who's gone on to enjoy worldwide recognition for his talents, and also notably Ian Ballamy and Tim Whitehead, who are often featured artists on Jazz Lineup. This is Jazz Lineup on BBC Radio 3 with me, Claire Martin. American jazz pianist and educator Lynn Arial is currently Professor of Jazz Piano at the University of North Florida, and she also enjoys a busy recording and touring schedule. She came to prominence when she won the 1993 International Great American Jazz Piano Competition, and the New York Times says her brilliant musicianship and bandstand instincts place her among the top jazz pianists of the day. Well, I caught up with her after a recent appearance at Ronnie Scott's, and we'll hear that interview after a track from her Convergence CD. And this is Call Me. From Convergence, that was Lynn Arial with Call Me. Lynn has dropped in to talk to Jazz Lineup about her brand new release. How was the gig last night?
Oh, we had a great time. We had a full house, and it's always wonderful to play with Benny Golson. We did about half the program trio, and then Benny came up, and he's the consummate storyteller. And, of course, playing his tunes is kind of a surreal experience.
I bet it is.
Yes. How many times has Along Came Betty been recorded and played, and Whisper Not and Stable Mates? And he's just a treasure.
Yeah. I bet the audience really absolutely lapped it up. I mean, he's really one of the greatest. How did you meet him? How did that come about that he was working with you?
We met 5 years ago. We have an agent in common, and Gabby Kleinschmidt, and she suggested that we play together, and Benny was so gracious, and he said yes. And I, of course, was thrilled. And we've been doing some things ever since.
Well, your latest CD, Solo, is, of course, a solo project, but it's the first time you've ever ventured out on your own after 20 years, really. Has it always been on the back burner, this idea, or is this something that's fresh idea?
Yes, it has been on the back burner, and it's a whole different genre. And there's a lot of responsibility on the pianist when you're playing solo, because there's nobody else there.
No one to blame.
Nobody to blame except yourself. And I have to have the conversation with myself and with my audience, or with the microphone if there's no audience. Mm.
But did you grow up, I mean, in your earlier career, did you do lots of solo gigs initially starting out? I mean, was that something that you enjoyed doing before you played with a trio? I mean, did you have to hark back to all those sort of restaurant gigs, or were you lucky enough to miss all that?
I did miss all that. I started out playing duos and trios.
Okay.
And so starting to play solo piano was really kind of daunting. Where do I start? Because there's such an incredible lineage. And now with my students, I insist that they work on solo piano technique right from the beginning. Because if you can play solo and cover, really be comfortable in that idiom and use the whole piano, then playing trio or duo is so much easier because you have more than you need.
How many students do you have, and what are you specifically teaching them, small group stuff?
Well, I'm at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville, and I have eight private students, and I also run the small ensembles program, and we have four combos, and they explore standard repertoire as well as anything their heart desires, and they bring in some amazing arrangements, and I really want them to stretch. You know, in addition to knowing standards and the Great American Songbook and the standards of jazz, I want them to also go beyond that and listen to world music and all the current music that's you know, available right now.
You've chosen tunes on it that you've recorded before and sort of reconsidered them, reconstructed them. Did that help or hinder you?
Yes, I wanted to do songs that I had already recorded and take a fresh look at them, right, and approach them differently.
One of the things that stood out for me on the solo album was actually wasn't a contemporary song. It's Wouldn't It Be Lovely? Tell me why you love that so much, and your take on it is just terrific. And did you spend a lot of time reharmonizing it? I've heard Cassandra Wilson do this, but I think this could possibly be my new favorite version.
Oh, thank you. Well, I love the song, and of course, I grew up listening to musicals when I was 3 or 4 years old. I wouldn't take naps unless I had music playing, and I remember My Fair Lady and Camelot and The Sound of Music, and later on, I remembered this song. Sometimes it just, you know, a song that you haven't thought about for 15 years just pops into your mind. And I remembered the sentiment, all I want is a room somewhere far away from the cold night air with one enormous chair. You know, it's so
just
beautiful.
You saying that's giving me goosebumps just hearing. I love that. I love that. Let's play it.
Okay.
Hear from her solo album, Lynn Arielle, and Wouldn't It Be Lovely? Thank you. Lerner and Lowe's Wouldn't It Be Lovely, played beautifully by Lynn Ariel from her new solo album. Talk to Lynn about this at the moment. Lynn, tell me, you work mostly in the US, or do you like coming to Europe and playing?
I come to Europe a lot, and the UK a fair amount, and I've had some beautiful experiences playing in many different places over the years. Last year I went to South Africa, and the year before that to Australia as well. When I was in South Africa, I played with full symphony orchestra and big band combined.
Fantastic.
And they arranged a bunch of my originals, and so that was wild, playing with such a huge group. And I love coming to Europe and the UK. The audiences are very responsive, and they're very lovely people. I've had a great pleasure of meeting many.
What do you say to your female students who might be, you know, a bit daunted by this sort of gender imbalance in jazz music?
They don't ask me about it too much. Occasionally, if they say, oh, it's because I'm a woman, whatever they, you know, whatever they're complaining about, I say to them, it may be true. Don't even bother going there, because it's a waste of your energy. You're not going to change whatever it is, and use this as a personal challenge to deal with someone who may possibly have a bias, and maybe they don't. And so we have to just pretend that everything's an equal playing field and just take it as it is. And you know, I often get asked, and I'm sure you do too, what's it like being a woman in jazz? How is it? How has your career been affected by it? And I always say the same thing. I will never know. The only way I would know would be to be a man and play exactly the way I do.
Yeah.
And so we won't have that opportunity.
That's a great answer. I mean, are there many women on your course? I mean, are you sort of heartened by the amount of women that are coming through
your
university?
Yes, there are several, and they're really good. Yeah,
fantastic.
They're excellent.
So who inspires you when you go out and buy music now? I mean, who's revving you up?
Oh, different world music, folk music. I love Keith Jarrett, Richie Bayrack, who's a mentor of mine. The list is very, very long. Every time I listen to music, I learn something. Mm. And for example, when I was exploring solo piano technique, there's so many different approaches. There's the very florid approach. There's, you know, a stride, and there are all kinds of ways of doing it. And we as artists have to kind of carve out our own niche and find what resonates for us, and hopefully that will reach our audience.
Tell us about the session and the Night in Tunisia.
Well, Night in Tunisia is a very involved arrangement. It took me a long time to write it, actually. I wrote it years ago, and I realized, I thought, you know, this isn't done yet. And most of the time, I will write it
to you. It has to be harder.
It has to be harder, right. The cake wasn't ready to be taken out of the oven yet, you know, and it wasn't done, and I realized that it needed a heightened energy or a slam bang finish, so to speak, and so I rewrote it, and this is maybe 9 months after I'd written it the first time, because, you know, it needed to get more and more intense towards the end, and I kept the essence of the tune, but there are a lot of interludes and a lot of modulations. It goes all over the place.
Fantastic.
And that's kind of the story of A Night in Tunisia.
Thank you. A Night in Tunisia, played by pianist Lynn Ariel from her Nuance album. Randy Brecker on the album plays trumpet and flugel with George Mraz on bass and Anthony Pincotti on drums. This is Jazz Lineup on BBC Radio 3 with me, Claire Martin, online, on FM and on digital radio. Rassan Roland Kirk, who's recently been described by jazz writer Nick Coleman as truly a raucous child of Charlie Mingus, played many instruments, sax, clarinet, flute, mazola and nose whistle. Renowned for his onstage vitality where improvisations accompanied comic banter and political ranting, he was idolised by Jimi Hendrix and was a major exponent of the circular breathing technique adopted by so many Reedsmen nowadays. In 1965, he started recording for the major label Atlantic Records, a partnership to last for a dozen recordings until 1976. While these recordings have now been compiled and released by Warner Jazz, liner notes by our very own Kevin Legendre. From disc 2, this is track 7, Portrait of Those Beautiful Ladies. I wonder what inspired Roland Kirk's title, Portrait of Those Beautiful Ladies, taken from Spirits Up Above from the Atlantic years 1965 to 1976. The 22-track collection, sequenced more or less chronologically, is out now on Warner Jazz. This is Claire Martin on BBC Radio 3, and you're listening to Jazz Lineup. Well, our set this week is an exclusive session from Shabaka Hutchins, our current Radio 3 new generation jazz artist, and he's with me to talk through the session. Welcome, Shabaka.
Hi, Claire.
Nice to see you at last we meet.
Yeah, great to be here.
So this session was recorded at the BBC Maida Vale Studios back in May.
Yeah.
You're playing clarinet. You've got Otto Fischer on guitar, Oren Marshall on tuba, and Richard Spaven on drums.
Yeah.
This is your latest band, is it? How did you meet these members?
Basically, a couple of months ago, some French guys came over and were doing a series of kind of documentary short films about young musicians in London.
Great.
And they put together me and Oren and Richard Spaven. And we played, and it was, as soon as we played, there was a kind of instant rapport, and it was just like we were a band. So we kind of jokingly said, you know, this shouldn't be one of those things that just happens once.
But Oren is a tuba player, and yeah. I was just transfixed, because it's quite a tough gig for him, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, I presume he's got a six-pack by now. All that.
Well, I play with him in my regular band, which is Sons of Kemet, which is two drummers, Tom Skinner and Seb Rotswood, and Oren on tuba, and myself on sax. So I'm kind of used to the fact that he's a bit of an ultra-human.
Yeah, basically. I mean, he really never gets a break at all, does he?
No, he doesn't get a break.
So let's talk about the first tune we're going to hear, which is called Joyous, a tune by you. What inspired this?
It was basically a set of chord sequences that I got off Nielsen's Wind Quintet. And I just heard this kind of short passage. It was completely amazing. I transcribed it, got a few chords, and then decided, this is really great. I'm just going to write a tune based on one or two chords that I just got this feeling from. And then the whole kind of tune just developed from the feeling of this very, very small passage, which isn't complex at all, but it was just, it had a certain feeling that I said, I want
that. It touched you.
Yeah.
Let's hear it. This is Joyous from your Maida Vale session. Thank you. I'm currently talking to Shebaka Hutchins. Shebaka, that was joyous. And before we hear the next track, Harvest Moon, you write in all sorts of styles. Tell us what your sort of main inspiration has been, because I know you went back to Barbados as a young lad and spent quite a long time listening to reggae and calypso. So is it a real, you know, mixed bag of all those things you grew up with?
Well, my main thing when trying to compose is not to limit myself. I might listen to certain musics in a certain period. Because I might say, I might want this to be inside me a bit more than something else, say. But when I sit down to write, I just see what, I kind of get a first idea, whether that's a musical idea on paper or just a kind of theoretical, you know, kind of completely off in top of my head. And then I just see where it takes me and where kind of logically it goes.
And when you were born here,
yeah.
What was the music you were exposed to first of all before you went back to Barbados?
I mean, I think the earliest album I can remember is Tracy Chapman's first album.
You're so young.
Of that time, basically. And, you know, kind of early reggae things like Bunny Wailer and, you know, the early Bob Marley records. My mother was trying to get me into jazz, but I didn't want anything to do with it.
Bad mum.
Yeah. So, I heard Courtney Pine's first album.
Yeah, he was quite a mentor to you, wasn't he?
Yeah, really? When I moved to England, he kind of really took me under his wing and, like, talked to me quite a bit and kind of showed me, you know, things. And yeah.
Fantastic. So tell us about the next track, Harvest Moon.
Harvest Moon, I just wrote this specifically for this this combination. Richard Spavin is one of my favourite drummers. He's played a lot with guys in the Broken Beat scene, like Heidi Tatum, and that's how I first met him. And he's played a lot with Flying Lotus. And I kind of really like that kind of thing of a kind of, I guess quite dance music, of a kind of sonic bass that's not really going anywhere. It's like what me, Oren and Otto are doing isn't the main focus. The main focus is the kind of movement of just this kind of swirl of sound and chords, and Richard Spavin is creating like interest in his drums.
Let's hear the track Harvest Moon. Oren Marshall's last note finishing Harvest Moon Shabaka. He's got quite a story, hasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, Oren's played with most of the big orchestras in England. He's, I think, touring with LSO around 18 or something ridiculous like
was
that.
Was he really?
He's just played with so many, he's gone through so many phases playing lots of orchestral stuff, lots of free improvisation, lots of groove, lots of kind of world music and African stuff. He's a really phenomenal musician.
Wow. Your term of new generation artist ends in September.
Yeah.
How have the past 2 years been for you?
It's been really great. On one level, it's been that I can indulge myself in having ideas and kind of carrying them to the, you know, logical conclusions and kind of having these things documented and having the resources and facilities to kind of make that happen.
So the new generation, the two years is up for you, yeah, in September. So what's been the highlights of the past 2 years?
Doing a duo with Julian Joseph was great. It was really, really good. Because someone I've respected for a long time. The Copland Concerto, which I played with the BBC Welsh Orchestra, was really, really great. And it kind of focused, I think, that area of my life, because there was so much preparation to go into it. It really kind of did a lot for me to kind of have that big thing to kind of fear for a massive period of time. And the biggest thing, I think, is still coming up, which is I'm writing a piece for the BBC Concert Orchestra, plus my group, Sons of Kemet, plus Leaf Cutter John and Jason Singh.
Okay, when's that? That'd be at the London Jazz Festival?
Yeah, in November.
At the Barbican?
At the Queen Elizabeth Hall.
So do you feel like being a new generation artist also afforded you the luxury of, you know, being a bit, cherry-picking a little bit and being a bit more relaxed about the things you decided to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm a natural-born cherry-picker. So I kind of think it allows me to just kind of cater to those kind of whims that I have and not feel like they're kind of all amounting to nothing.
You're quite young to have so much recognition. You're very well respected at a young age. And I'm wondering, how did you get your chops together in Barbados? I've just done a gig, luckily, I'm happy to say, in Barbados. And how did you nurture your musical ambitions there?
Because I did all the grades. An examiner flies down to the island every
An examiner
year.
Flies down here, yeah. I was wondering.
So I did grade 8 and all the classical grades. I did at 14 and did all the kind of... I played in the Barbados some youth orchestra, and I actually played double bass in the youth orchestra for a few years, yeah.
But do you feel like you've been quite lucky since you've been here? Obviously, you've stumbled on a few people that, as you said, have taken you under your wing.
Yeah, but, I mean, it kind of feels like I've just been running around feeling bad about my playing and trying to get it together and somehow getting gigs in the process. And then when I kind of stop running and freaking out about the state of my you know, mouthpieces and playing in general. I realise I've done quite a bit.
You have done quite a bit. Now, you play both clarinet and sax, but you stuck to clarinet for our session.
Yeah.
Why was that?
I think there's something to be said for just playing one instrument, basically, and especially kind of forming a set around limitations of one thing. And the B-flat clarinet, as opposed to the bass clarinet, is really, really still seldom used in jazz. The bass clarinet's kind of becoming more and more popular, but the smaller clarinet, because it is sonically harder to kind of make it, you know, diverse, kind of do a whole set, not a lot of people use it, and it's kind of my first instrument. But it's easy to kind of, you know, think you've got a loud tune, I'll pick up the sax and that'll fit. So I decided I'm just going to stay on the clarinet and make it work.
Let's hear Forest in the Dream. Do you want to tell us a bit about this next track?
Yeah, the Forest in the Dream, I kind of came up with the title first, then wrote the music, because I really wanted to get that dreamlike atmosphere where you've got a kind of, I don't know, almost like a very pure thing kind of nestled inside, a kind of very rugged thing. And you kind of imagine those old Germanic, you know, Brothers Grimm things where you've got like a kind of really serene little house in the middle of like a really, you know, kind of wicked kind
sounds
of forest.
Like Hove, where I live.
Yeah, so I kind of thought, how can I get this, you know, this atmosphere of having like a really pure melody in midst. And it's actually, it's a tune I didn't write specifically for this group. It's quite an old tune that I've done once before on a BBC session. I think with Seb Rochford and Kit Downs.
Let's hear it. Forest in the Dream. recorded at the BBC Maida Vale Studios in May. That was Shebeka Hutchins on clarinet, Otto Fischer on guitar, Oren Marshall on tuba and pretending to be a forest, I think, there. Yeah. And Richard Spavin on drums, and I'm talking to Shebeka. Now, you're quite a keen blogger, aren't you? You've posted quite a lot of videos that have inspired you on your site, which I was looking at this morning. It's an amazing one of some African women dancing in a
heart.
It absolutely blew me away. Where was that?
It's in South Africa.
Right.
And it's basically, I can't remember the, I think it's Madassini. The one that you must have watched. And she's playing an old bowmaster.
Terrific, yeah, really great.
Really the way they were doing music, yeah.
Stunning. So you're a keen blogger.
Yeah, I think web presence is quite important. There's a Jason Moran tune that I listened to years ago off his Artist in Residence album, and it's called Artists Should Be Writing, where he takes this this speech by Angela Davis, basically talking about the fact that artists need to let people know like what's inspired them and like what they're actually doing as opposed to the audience second-guessing their motives from what they hear. Mm. And I, you know, it's always stuck with me that, you know, people don't know what you're getting at.
Yeah, so I suppose if there's no words, you know, like it's easy for a singer, isn't it? We're talking them through it. Yeah. They've got to sort of, you're sort of giving them a clue.
Yeah, and in some ways, you know, some people say the music can speak for itself, but it doesn't always, basically. You know, especially with differing levels of, you know, I spend all my life engaged in music. If someone just comes and experiences it for like an hour or a week, they'll have a different reality in terms of what music means. So I think letting people know where you're at, what you're thinking about, is really, you know, it's
great.
Really important.
So before we play the last track, which is called Chick Chicka, which is a Mulatu tune, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Just tell us once again about the London Jazz Festival gig, because that's probably the biggest thing you've done.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of writing.
Or going to do.
I'm basically writing a piece for the concert orchestra with my group and Luke Adedon and Jason Singh, and trying to get basically a way to bring all those things together.
Have you started it?
I've started it.
Okay.
It's one of those things where I've started it. I've kind of outlined what I want to happen throughout the piece. I started to write the orchestral writing, but it's always a kind of a journey. I don't know how it's going to end.
Mm, great.
I just start it and I write and I write and I write. Then an edit. It's just a lot of kind of faffing around, being on tube journeys with my headphones on writing.
You've just made some videos about people who inspire you. Tell us, who were those people and tell me about that experience.
Well, the people were Nathaniel Facey, Jay Phelps, Steve Williamson, Alex Hawkins and Pete Wareham. And I basically, from that, off the same kind of issue of needing to know what people are thinking about, these artists are thinking about, I was reading lots of interviews and kind of thinking there's lots and lots of talking about what they're doing, the specifics of what they're doing, which, you know, when I talk to my kind of quote-unquote normal friends, it doesn't really kind of interest
civilians.
Them. Yeah, when I speak to civvies, it's kind of, it's interesting if you've heard the album, but for instance, if you're coming to a jazz artist who you don't really kind of know their work or even appreciate their work at first listen, most people, I realise, want to know about them, like what their views are, in, you know, in terms of aesthetically and you know, what they think about certain things. So I thought I'd like to get these people that I really appreciate.
And what were they like? Did they step up? Were they good? Because
sometimes
musicians can be good talkers and like you, or sometimes be a little bit more reserved.
I found there were certain themes that ran through all of them, which was surprising.
I'd really like to watch those. If anybody wants to see those, where could we watch them?
Via the BBC Radio 3 website. Look for Jazz.
It's really lovely to meet you. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time. Thank you so much for coming in. Let's hear the last track, Chick Chicka, good title.
Yeah.
And it's Shebeka Hutchins with Otto Fischer on guitar, the wonderful Oren Marshall playing tuba and Richard Spavin on drums. The book.
Thank you.
Chick Chicka, written by Mulatu Astaki and played by Shabaka Hutchins on clarinet, Otto Fischer on guitar, Oren Marshall on tuba and Richard Spaven on drums. And that was recorded at the BBC Maida Vale Studios in West London during May. And you can see those videos by going to the BBC New Generation Artist page on the BBC Radio 3 website. To end today, something from the winners of the Best Ensemble category at this year's Parliamentary Jazz Awards, so opening and closing our programme with well-deserved winners. Their new CD is their first on the ECM label and features specially commissioned new big band arrangements of well-known pieces by Dave Holland, Chick Corea, Jan Garbrick and Keith Jarrett. This is the Jan Garbrick composition Mauled Canticle Part 1, arranged by Tommy Smith and featuring bassist Harold Anderson. the Scottish National Jazz Orchestra, with bassist Harold Anderson, joining Tommy Smith, the director and powerhouse tenor soloist of the orchestra. Well, that's it for this week. Kevin Ajomra is here next week with Soweto Kinch in concert at this year's Glasgow Jazz Festival. Jazz on 3 tomorrow night is Phronesis, one of the most exciting young bands on the British scene, and they're in concert at King's Place in London, playing music from their new album, Walking Dark. Till next time from me, Claire Martin. Bye-bye.
Hello, I'm John Shea and welcome to Through the Night on BBC Radio 3. The 2010 Musica Antiqua Festival in Bruges featured the group Baroque in a programme called On the Road to Mozart's Harem. The sound of cymbals, triangle and bass drum, characteristic of his opera The Abduction from the Seraglio, had fascinated composers since these instruments were left behind on the battlefield by the defeated Turks after their 1683 siege of Vienna. A century on, Gluck and Haydn also replayed the conflict on the operatic stage, as we'll hear shortly. Hasse began the trend in his 1753 opera Solimano. Here's the overture, then the percussion bursts in with some jazz-like improvisations in the first movement of a Turkish symphony by Süssmayr. Three arias, one by Haydn, sandwiched between two by Gluck. His two Turkish operas were Le Cadi Dupé and La Rencontre Imprévue. The former had its roots in the Tales of 1001 Nights, and the latter told the same story.